At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is radio, which means it's tough to do charts and graphs, so plain old-fashioned numbers are going to have to do. The U.S. economy lost almost 20,000 jobs a day last month. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, the 6th of February. Great to have you here. I'm going to get out of the way and let the president deliver the punchline on today's jobs report.
The problem is accelerating, not decelerating. It's getting worse, not getting better.
Even if you wanted to, it's tough to argue with that. 598,000 jobs lost last month. The unemployment rate is now 7.6%. If we could plot this on a graph for you, it would be a curve where the slope is rapidly approaching vertical. Because as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington, sometimes accelerating job losses just lead to more job losses.
As if last month's figures weren't bad enough, turns out the Labor Department's horrendous figures for last year were off. The number of jobs lost since the recession began in December of 2007 is now 3.6 million, hundreds of thousands more than previously thought.
That's 3.6 million Americans who wake up every day wondering how they are going to pay their bills, stay in their homes, and provide for their children.
And it's 3.6 million Americans doing a lot less spending. Stephen Tully of Pasadena, California is one of them. He's been laid off since March.
Well, we cut out a cell phone off of our account. We don't go out to eat at all anymore. Whenever possible, we drive together so that we don't waste any extra gas.
He's spending about $500 less per month than he used to. Kevin Hassett directs economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He says even people who still have jobs but think they could be next are cutting back.
It's clear that fear is driving people's behavior right now, and that's going to mean that there's going to be reduced consumption, and that's going to lead to more job loss.
Hassett says big numbers like today's scare employers, too. That leads to bigger job cuts in anticipation of what the coming year will be like.
Employers wonder, what are my sales going to be? And start to think about what they can do to get their costs in line.
Something Hassett says they've already been doing for months. One reason that the unemployment number keeps snowballing. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
So that guy Jeremy was talking to a minute ago, the one from Pasadena, Stephen Tully, here's what he said when he heard about the 600,000 people who joined him last month on the unemployment lines.
I'm a statistic.
Truth is, Mr. Tully's a statistic in more ways than one. Maybe you saw the New York Times story today that 82% of all layoffs in this recession have been men. Marketplace's Steve Henn picks up our unemployment story.
This recession has hit male-dominated industries like construction and manufacturing hard, and it's biting into management jobs like Tully's. Today, Tully's working again, but just temp jobs, and his wife is earning about twice his salary.
It was a big switch that's not been an easy year. The finances are tight, and it's more arguments over money.
Heather Boucher is an economist at the Center for American Progress.
Unemployment has risen much farther and faster for men than it has for women.
Boucher says in the last 30 years, our standard of living rose largely because more women worked. But on average, women still earn less than men, and...
In the typical married couple family, the woman brings home about a little over a third of the total family income.
The Tullys were typical. So when Stephen Tully lost his job, his wife Michelle says the family budget had a gaping hole.
At one point, we had to actually go to a church for a food bank to help us get through the week. And that's a scary feeling. That's a very humbling feeling.
Now Stephen Tully's doing more chores, cooking, and caring for the kids.
Oh, of course, yeah. He's, you know, for a while there we were calling him the man-made because he was doing all the housework while they worked.
These kinds of changes in home economics may not be permanent, though. Boucher warns if the economy continues to weaken, fields dominated by women like education and state government are likely to see a larger share of layoffs. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Now we're going to give you a glimpse at Monday's news. The Obama administration is set to outline its plans for the second half of the $700 billion bank bailout. That would be TARP in the vernacular. The first pass at handing out $350 billion to the nation's bank was widely criticized for changing strategies and for a lack of accountability. So our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the TARP's new overseers are going back to the original idea.
Under TARP 1, the government poured money into troubled banks, figuring they would lend it out into the economy. But the banks still owned billions of dollars worth of shaky assets, so they hoarded the government's money to cover their anticipated losses. In TARP Take 2, Treasury will buy those troubled assets from the banks by expanding a Federal Reserve Bank lending program. Banks like that idea. Scott Talbot with the Financial Services Roundtable calls it an elegant solution.
The Federal Reserve can take the TARP money and combine it with its own lending power, and you get a multiplier effect there that can't be duplicated with other regulatory bodies.
As the leading financial industry regulator, the Fed already has experts at its regional banks who should know how to value the bad assets on the bank's books. Treasury may also inject more capital into failing banks, like last time, but this time with more conditions, like limits on executive salaries and shareholder dividends. There may be other ideas, too, but James Barth, an historian of the SNL failures of the 1980s, says he's looking mainly for consistency in the Treasury Secretary's announcement.
We're hoping there'll be a clear voice expressed on Monday or sometime soon exactly what's going to be done, and the administration won't be flip-flopping. A big enemy of capital markets is obviously uncertainty. It's hard to reassure people things are being done the right way if every other day there's a new game plan.
Barth says regulators in the past were shooting from the hip, and their target was unclear. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street somehow managed to find a silver lining in today's jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Go ahead and think about this if the economy is keeping you up at night. As demand for everything from toys to rolled steel has dropped, so too has the amount of pollution generated by all the plants that make all those things. That in turn is playing out in the European carbon markets where traders buy and sell permits for the right to pollute. Applying the laws of supply and demand here, there is less demand for pollution if there is less demand for production. And in fact, since July, those permit prices are down nearly 70%. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The European carbon market was set up by countries that signed on to the Kyoto Climate Treaty. It basically allows polluters to buy and sell the right to release greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Each credit is the equivalent of a ton of CO2. And as recently as July, those credits were fetching as much as $40. But Mark Trexler with the consulting firm EcoSecurity says with the global economy in a slump, those days are over.
People just aren't emitting nearly as much CO2 as they thought they would.
Now, heavy polluters like Europe's cement, steel, and paper industries are all trying to unload their excess credits at once. That's driven the price of carbon down from its $40 peak to this week's record low of about $13 a ton.
People have invested a lot of money in these markets over the last 4 or 5 years, and a lot of that money is vanishing right now.
And as the money vanishes, so does the confidence many people have in carbon markets as a way to reduce global emissions. President Obama wants the U.S. to take a leadership role at December's U.N. climate meeting in Copenhagen. But critics of passing a similar cap-and-trade program here in the U.S. say the European carbon market isn't working. Jonathan Lash with the World Resources Institute disagrees. He says the falling price of carbon isn't necessarily a bad thing.
The fact that supply temporarily exceeds demand and prices fall doesn't seem to me an indicator that markets aren't working, but that they are.
He says unlike a carbon tax, which imposes a set price on emissions, cap and trade allows prices to rise and fall with the economy. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
A lot happened this week, but it all pales in comparison to those 598,000 people who don't have jobs anymore. As we set up top, both job losses and the unemployment rate rose last month, and that is going to have a negative impact on just about everything in this economy, including, quite possibly, prices. To help us wrap up the week on Wall Street and beyond, we've got Lee Gallagher with us. She's an editor at Fortune magazine. Mike Mandel is chief economist at Business Week. Good to have you both back.
Thanks, Kai.
Glad to be here.
So, Lee, I wanted to start with you on something that's sort of been bubbling around out there, and it comes to light more because of the numbers out there today. The prospect that decreasing demand in this economy, that is with fewer people working, more jobs being lost, people aren't going to be spending as much. What is that going to do to prices and the issue of deflation?
Deflation is essentially, as you say, it's a spiral of falling prices that sort of feeds upon itself because prices fall, which then makes consumers delay purchases because they expect prices to fall more. So it's just this sort of vicious circle of downward falling prices that ends up sort of slowing everything. So, you know, the fear is we're already in this slowdown, but this could be the beginning of a long, slow retrenchment.
Mike, your thoughts, deflation?
Well, I don't think what we're seeing is classic deflation. Things like furniture and autos and a lot of goods that are globally traded with this massive overproduction, we see prices collapsing. But in other parts of the economy, in the services and what I call the intangible sector, education, healthcare, and so forth, you actually see prices still rising. So what I see is not quite so apocalyptic a picture. I see that the things that are in overproduction, the prices are falling, which is kind of what you'd expect.
Now, I don't want to name drop here, though, but I was reading Paul Krugman this week. The guy's won a Nobel Prize. He writes on economics a lot. And he is cataclysmically worried about this prospect of spiraling lower prices, deflation. You're not buying that?
You know, I mean, I respect Paul a lot. I've had debates with him over the years. I think that his main point is that you should pass the stimulus bill quickly, and I agree with that. One of the big things that's happening here is that we're having massive destruction of jobs, mainly in the goods-producing sector. But that doesn't mean that things are quite as apocalyptic as it seems.
Lee, what is your sense of the supply-demand thing? Is it oversupply or is it under-consumption, not enough demand?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, you really saw this reflected in the GDP figures for the fourth quarter. I mean, the big headline was goods piled up. People weren't buying, so inventory was piling up, and actually output was increased so that the real GDP figure might have even been lower. It was 3.8%. It might have been slowed more to the effect of 5%. So I think it's a combination of things. I mean, there's no doubt that the consumer has basically fallen off a cliff. But some people are raising prices. I mean, Colgate and P&G have raised prices on a few things. McDonald's, which is doing well, which has been pretty well documented lately, has raised prices. So some companies are doing that.
Getting back to the story of the day then, the stimulus package, Lee, do you think this is going to do anything, all this government spending is going to do anything to fix deflationary tendencies and increase demand?
I think it will. I mean, one of the risks with deflation, well, a few risks with it. One of the issues is that there's not an instant cure for it. I mean, unlike inflation, which you can, you know, sort of choke off with interest rates, deflation really is a little bit more problematic in that way. And, you know, the stimulus bill, whatever you say about it, it will have an effect. It will produce a sort of caffeine-like jolt to the economy in the form of jobs and in the form of spending. So that will do something to stave off deflation.
Mike, what's your sense of this stimulus package and whether or not it's going to do anything about deflation and stimulating demand?
Well, look at where the money in the stimulus package is going. In the House bill, on the spending side, Two-thirds of it is going into healthcare and education, areas where prices are still going up. This is not a bill which is designed to stem deflation. This is a bill which is designed to reinforce this transition from a goods-based economy to a services and tangible-based economy.
Michael Mendel at Businessweek, Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, bad times mean big opportunity for debt collectors.
Elections is going to be a growth market from an outsourcing standpoint. Definitely, yes.
But first, let's do the numbers. That bad jobs report made for a good day on Wall Street. Investors bet Congress would finally be forced to pass the stimulus package. Dow Industrials larded on 2.7%, 217 points, closed at 8,280. The NASDAQ ramped up nearly 3%, 45 points, ended the day at 1591. The S&P 500 charged up 2.3%, 22 points, closed at 868. For the week, and it was a good one for a change, the Dow pulled up 3.5%, the NASDAQ added 7.8%. The S&P 500 moved up 5.2%. Financial shares soared on hopes that a bank rescue plan will boost the economy. J.P. Morgan Chase chalked up a 12.5% gain. Citigroup added 10.75%. Bank of America charged up nearly 27% today. That after its CEO, Ken Lewis, said the bank will not need more government bailout money. Overseas markets were up across the board. Bond prices fell back home. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The evening television lineup shifts for President Obama. He's holding his first primetime news conference. The American Council on Education continues its annual meeting in Washington. And on February 9th, 1870, the U.S. Weather Bureau was established, making talk about the weather official business. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As we speak, the Senate's stimulus package is inching ever closer to $1 trillion. There is a bipartisan group that's trying to shave that down some. Probably not too much lower than the House's $819 billion version, though. Christina Romer is one of the people whose job it is to help figure out how much is enough and how it ought to be spent. She chairs the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Dr. Romer, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
The job numbers this morning, obviously, is the place to start. They were not entirely surprising, still very sobering. How do you think they are going to affect passage of the stimulus plan?
I found them incredibly sobering. So losing 600,000 more jobs just in the month of January was truly frightening. And the data revision, so that we now know we've lost 3.6 million jobs since this recession started 13 months ago. So I think they do reinforce the idea that this downturn, which has been bad, is accelerating. And I think they will put a lot of pressure on both Congress and the president to make sure we get this stimulus package passed.
What are some of those tools that are in the stimulus package as it exists now on the floor of the Senate that are going to help the economy grow?
I think the important thing is, or one of the things that I really like about the package is that it's balanced, right? That it isn't all one kind of fiscal stimulus or the other. And I think that's incredibly important. Things like the middle class tax cut, right? That's something we can do quickly. It gets money into people's hands quickly. So we think that's going to give us a lift. I think the state fiscal relief is important because that, again, gets out the door very quickly and prevents layoffs of teachers and nurses and first responders. And then the spending increases, those more long-run investments like infrastructure and health IT and education. I mean, I think that's going to be incredibly important for creating jobs now, but also for making us more productive in the future.
But we could line up a whole bunch of economists who would say none of that stuff is really good stimulus. What we need is direct government spending, and we need it right now, not 18 months or 2 years from now. How do you convince them?
I think I would convince them by saying, look at the plan. Actually, there's a lot of direct fiscal stimulus. That's certainly the aid to the states is going directly into making sure that we don't lay off state workers. A lot of the spending as well goes out very quickly. I mean, certainly there are parts of it that take a little bit longer to get out the door, but we know that there's, for example, money in there to extend unemployment insurance. That is ideal kind of countercyclical policy that gets out quickly and gets money into people's hands so that they're spending.
Back to the jobs numbers for this morning. Do you think it's more important that this package create new jobs or save the ones that we have that are being lost so quickly?
It's really part and parcel of the same thing, right? What we need to do is to get the economy growing again. What's important is that on net, the number of jobs is going up, right? Because that's going to be incredibly important for average Americans that are suffering, as we see in our unemployment numbers.
How confident are you? How confident is the president that whatever he winds up having to sign is going to be big enough to do it?
I think the important thing is that we get a good package out. You know, one of the things that the president has certainly made a top priority is that this package be, you know, unusual in the degree of accountability, transparency. The way I like to think of it is we're going to be monitoring this thing from the day it passes and watching, are we creating the jobs? Is the spending going out as quickly as it needs to? Are we spending money wisely? And I think we're going to be watching like we've never watched before.
Christina Romer, chairs the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama. Dr. Romer, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Obviously, there are different points of view about what kinds of spending make for good stimulus. There hasn't been much talk yet, though, about doing nothing. And that leaves plenty of room for commentator and economist Susan Lee.
No doubt about it. Almost $1 trillion is a huge number. And so it's good that we're having a huge debate over the stimulus package. Is it too big, too small? Should it be mostly government spending or mostly tax cuts? We're debating everything except for the most important question. Will it work? There's a respectable body of opinion that there's no stimulus in a stimulus. This argument, called Ricardian equivalence after the British economist David Ricardo, goes like this. In an economic downturn, the government wants to boost demand by spending more money than it takes in taxes. But how will the government get that extra money? Not by raising taxes. That's foolish in the middle of a recession. The only way for government to get extra billions of dollars is to borrow it. But as this over-leveraged country is beginning to understand, debt must be paid back. And how will the government pay back the debt? You guessed it. By raising taxes, later when the economy is going gangbusters again. The hooker is this. When people realize that their taxes will have to go up eventually to pay off the debt, they'll start saving today. And the extra money motored out by the government will be offset by the money motored in by taxpayers. The net may very well be a checkmate. Government spending goes up, private spending goes down, and demand stays the same. Although there's some evidence that Ricardo himself didn't believe in equivalence, academic economists have been debating it for decades. Some objections are theoretical. For example, not everyone can save today for an eventual tax hike down the road, and the empirical evidence is mixed. Now, of course, one can always stand on the acceptable ground that academic economists would know a payroll from a sesame seed roll. But before hitting the economy with a deficit that could top 10% of gross domestic product, shouldn't Congress take a look at the argument that a stimulus won't work? Shouldn't it question whether the economy will get any bang for so many billions of bucks?
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. No matter where you live, send us your thoughts about what you hear on the program. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Granted, you have to look pretty hard to see them, but there are some economic positives to this recession. Falling prices mean paychecks go farther. And according to the Federal Reserve today, Americans are pulling back on the plastic. Actually, all consumer borrowing was off in December. Besides just credit cards, it's things like car loans and personal lines of credit, too. Still, there are bills to pay, and the farther we fall behind, the more new opportunities are created half a world away. Raymond Thibodeau has more now on the Indian debt collection business.
Hi, it was Maurice. Actually, we're calling about your credit card account with us.
Meet Jay. At least, that's the name he uses over the phone. Your next bill collector could be someone like him.
Yeah, your existing credit card is showing that's running in arrears by 3 payments right now.
At this busy call center in New Delhi, nearly 300 young collection agents sit in neat rows of cubicles, wearing telephone headsets and punching data into their computers. Like many here, Jay says he's surprised that so many Americans struggle to pay their bills. That's good news if you happen to be in the business of collecting debts. It's even better news if your business is in India.
Collections is going to be a growth market from an outsourcing standpoint. Definitely, yes.
That's Aparoop Sengupta, the chief executive officer of Aegis, a firm that handles collections for companies like American Express and Bank of America. At this point, American consumers are facing nearly $1 trillion in outstanding debt. And Indians, as it turns out, are particularly good at getting some of that money back, partly by tapping into Sengupta's notion that most people want to pay their debts.
Human beings across the world, especially in the West, they have a tendency to pay. And if you understand that, our job is to work as performing artists and work with customers as partners to find out how can we solve their problem.
Understanding American spending habits is part of what makes collection agents in India better at getting people to pay up. Studies show that Indian agents are on the phone 25% longer than American bill collectors. But Indians collect about 20% more money per call. And that's what counts, says Raman Roy, who heads the Delhi-based outsourcing firm Quattro. Taking extra time to build rapport with debtors, he says, apparently pays off.
It's based on their compassion. It is based on their hunger. Succeeding on the job means a lot more to you than to some of your international counterparts.
There is a hunger. These jobs are desperately sought after. Indian collection agents make about $5,000 a year. Roy calls that a king's ransom, a fortune in India. Still, it's less than a fifth of what their American counterparts make. For now, Indian agents collect a tiny percent of U.S. debt, but they're eager to get more American consumers to pay what they owe. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, one more snapshot of the labor market on the day we learned the economy cut almost 600,000 jobs last month. Layoffs have come to the Harvard Management Company. That's the group that, just like it sounds, manages Harvard's shrinking endowment. The university's financial backstop has lost $8 billion the past 4 months, about 22%. So 50 people at the management company, about a quarter of the staff, are going to lose their jobs. They will be part of the February unemployment report, which comes out a very short 4 weeks from today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 217 points, 2 2/3%. The NASDAQ rose 45 points, nearly 3%. The S&P 500 added 22 points, 2 2/3% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, bargains are there for the taking. You just have to ask.
I found that the two words customer retention are a magic carpet ride to a good consumer deal.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.